Radio.
The Bible and the Mystery of Self-Deception. A series of talks by Dr. Robert Tilley at the Catholic Institute of Sydney, held in May 2012. The topic of this second talk is Being Blind to Being Blind, the Corruption of Conscience and the Evasion of Self-Responsibility.
Okay, look, just a little bit of an overview, as it were, to ease into this is, look, first and foremost, about, I've said, my basic assumption is how we lie to others is how we lie to ourselves. And we do that by making ourselves double. How we do that to ourselves is one of the great mysteries. But there are many ways in which we do this. And one of those ways is we divide ourselves up, as it were, all the better to parcel ourselves out and to hide ourselves behind our own back, as St. Augustine put it. What I'm going to talk about tonight, I guess, is a corruption of conscience in order to justify our lying. But there are many ways in which we do it, and one of the ways is to create complexity. To focus not on what is most obvious and simple, but to create a needless complexity. And in this, it's very similar to what the prophets spoke of in ancient Israel in reference to idolatry. We multiply authorities. We multiply gods, or today we might multiply ethics and ethics committees. Because we all know in the end what it ends with. We all decide that there are so many differing pluralist views that no one view can be dominant, and the end result is pragmatism. And pragmatism is simply another term for really power. We also do this, and we manage to deceive ourselves through flattery, a self-flattery. And yet, at first this feels good, but very quickly gives a sense of emptiness. And then we try to get the feeling back again, the good feeling we once had. And finally, this is, as I say, a very brief overview, we justify any and all violence to others and to ourselves, and we blame others. Anyway, with that, I'll begin proper. And I'm going to begin with John 9, verses 40 to 41. Following on from the healing of a blind man, we read this rather paradoxical exchange between Jesus and certain Pharisees. Some Pharisees, we read, who were with Jesus, said, "Are we blind?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But because you now say, 'We see,' then your sins remain. If you were blind, you would have no sin. But because you now say, 'We see,' then your sin remains." There's somewhat of a paradox there. And I suppose we could spend a whole night trying to unpack what our Lord said there. But something a little similar to that can be found in one of the case histories of the neurophysiologist Oliver Sacks. Oliver Sacks wrote books like Anthropologists on Mars, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Awakenings, and so on and so forth. And he wrote of a case history in which, he called it the last hippie, but I suppose with my hair maybe that's not true, but there you are. He called it the last hippie, this guy from the 60s who had a very bad tumour, had it removed, but could no longer actually, one, create long-term memory, and secondly, because he had no visual cortex anymore, he was stone-cold blind. And yet, the man refused to acknowledge he was blind. He would say, "I'm not blind. If I were blind, I'd be the first person to know it," which, as Oliver Sacks has said, you know, it's rather a logical point to make, and yet it was wrong. He denied he was blind even when he was bumping into the furniture. And this, in a kind of horrid way, is the essence of pride and thus of self-deception. We can be blind to being blind. And this double blindness, this what I called last week the blinding of the blinds, is obviously not really in the case of the poor old hippie, but in our case, at least in the Pharisees' case, this blindness is deliberate, is willed, is intentional on our part, such that our sin remains. Our sin remains. Which is to say, our responsibility remains. But of course, again and again, we all seek to convince ourselves of our ignorance. I truly did not know I was blind. But in point of fact, we do. Perhaps the heart of all moral theology is the distinction that informs the difference between mortal and venial sin. But in a way, deeper still, you could say, the difference is the difference between invincible ignorance and culpable ignorance. The difference between invincible ignorance and culpable ignorance. And in this, there are, I think, only two who can judge between them in respect of ourselves. God, of course, and ultimately, I guess, we will be drawn to judge ourselves on this matter as well. So all the better to do it now, I think. And yet we will do anything to not judge ourselves, at least correctly. And we will principally do this by always judging others, first and foremost. The 14th century Augustinian, Walter Hilton, wrote, quote, of the high road of contemplation. And this is not a rare thing that was written by the church fathers and the later mystics. Let me put it like this. How many of you, when you hear the word contemplation or meditation, think about sitting in a nice, comfortable position or a yoga-type position, experiencing the kind of ecstasy that might come through the discipline of focused attention? How many of us think of contemplation in terms of reaching the kind of airy heights, or as Walter Hilton called it, to hear the song of angels? How many of us think that way? And yet, for them, contemplation and meditation, first of all, meant, as Walter Hilton put it, this is for a person to enter within themselves and to know their own soul and its powers. How beautiful it is, and how hideous. How beautiful the soul is, and yet how hideous. There is a need of humility, for of course the beautiful part of our soul is down to God and his creative work, but the ugliness, well, I guess we can claim that for our responsibility. There is a need of humility. Quote, to feel this humility will put out of your heart unreasonable regard for other people's misconduct and the judging of others. When you actually engage with that contemplative humility, you no longer think about the misconduct of others, but you think of yourself. And without humility, you will, quote, stumble about like a blind man, never attaining his object. The higher, Walter Hilton goes on to say, the higher the blind man climbs through bodily penances even, and other virtues, if he has not the virtue of humility, the lower he falls. And I guess that's a principle in, I suppose, it describes humanity. No other part of creation is as glorious and wondrous as we are. No other part. And yet no other part of creation can fall the foulest. Thus our Lord's admonition to not bother about the mote in our brother's eye, but the beam in our own. And this really is at the root of contemplation and meditation. If you do not go to contemplation and meditation through a radical self-critique of humility, you are deluding yourself. And you will hear the song of angels, you will have ecstasies, but they are comparatively quite easy to have. What I want to come to is this. All the mystics and the church fathers, and indeed you could say those in other religions who ventured along this same path, all of them pointed out the absolute necessity of objective institutional authority. Objective institutional authority, which is why one of the vows was obedience. And that certainly is not confined to the Christian religion. I guess that probably rankles us a bit. I imagine it does. We need it to judge, guide, and discipline us. Indeed, visible institutional authority is demanded for reasons we're going to explore tonight. Anyway, coming at it from another angle. In John, at the beginning of John's Gospel, we read that the light shone in the darkness, but the darkness does not comprehend the light. For the darkness has convinced itself that darkness is light. Why is it that the darkness cannot comprehend the light when you would think it'd be the most obvious thing of all? After all, there is darkness, and then suddenly a light shines. Surely that is obvious what the light is. But, as it says in the Gospel, the darkness does not comprehend it. Why? What is it that stops the darkness from comprehending the light? And the only answer I think that is credible is because the darkness has already decided what the light looks like, and the light looks like darkness. The darkness has convinced itself that darkness is light. So when the real light shines, the darkness says, "What on earth? What in hell is that?" We think our blindness is sight. And we do so because we've trained ourselves, we've formed a habit in order to understand it so. And as I said last week, we blind ourselves even to the intention to blind ourselves. We deceive ourselves in intending to forget that we set out to deceive ourselves. And I gave you an example last week that it is quite a natural ability to be able to forget our intentions, such as when we study and there's loud noise and we're trying to block out that noise by focusing our attention. And we do that. But as soon as we remember our intention to block out the noise, we hear the noise. The other factor, too, is this. One of the great, I guess, conceits of modernity was the idea that you could understand a text by reference to the one conscious intention of the author. Now, surely that's incredibly absurd and patently absurd. For we all know that we have multiple intentions and that at one time. For example, for good reason. For example, I like walking to Bondi in the morning. So it's about a 40-minute walk from where I live. And my intention as I walk ostensibly is to go for a swim and have a coffee. But as I walk, my other intention is to actually think about things and ruminate upon things. And this is what I do. And when I'm walking to Bondi, I am not aware, I do not remember consciously at the time my intention to walk to Bondi, because my intention to think about things is foremost. That is in respect of all our lives. Unfortunately, we misuse that ability, and we misuse it in order to intend to forget certain decisions we have made that are not good, that are not good. I said last week that we justify our lies in many and different ways. And we justify in order to hide things, not least our responsibility, hence our Lord's words to the Pharisees, because you say we are not blind, your sin still remains. And today, I think the chief way for many of us is by defining conscience to mean the very opposite of what it means. And doing so by defining conscience not as a location within us, as the voice of the other, but as the voice of the same, as our own. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that. Conscience is in point of fact the sense and the very essence of our transcendence of ourselves. It has to do with justice, with the voice of justice. And as we know, both from secular and religious authorities, or indeed ourselves, we know that justice has primarily to do with the rights of the other. And that's what conscience really has to do. It is the voice of God within us, but we are not God, and his voice is not ours. The conscience has become, in the modern period, the voice of the same, our voice. And I want to explore how that has come about. But certainly it's something that expresses itself today, and indeed in modernity, in the denigration of the authority of hierarchical institutions, be it the authority of the Church, of Rome, of the Pope, or of the state, or of trade unions, or much else. It is the elevation of the autonomous individual. But in order, again, to come back to this, to draw it all together, we're going to take something of a circuitous route here. And this is in reference to a number of things, of feedback from last week. It is not infrequently said, and believe me, I have heard these responses at other times I've given series on self-deception. It is not infrequently said that this, such a topic as this, can lead to scruples. To scruples, to scrupulosity, by which we mean an unhealthy and destructive tendency to see in ourselves all manner of small and subtle sins. Of course, it is a very healthy thing to see one's sins, and yes, that's what this series is about. But what is meant is seeing guilt where there is none. In other words, scrupulosity is the loss of the sense of proportion. And indeed, it's fabrication, of course. Probably the best historical example of this is Martin Luther. Martin Luther very famously suffered from scrupulosity. And in that, there's something salutary. There were undoubtedly many good reasons for Luther's critique of the church at the time, clearly. But in terms of his actions, I guess there's a lot that should be criticized. But the problem is with scrupulosity, it can lead to schism or indifference. Because, of course, one starts to think, well, the hell with it. I'm not going to bother at all. But my major point is this. By creating a whole lot of stuff about small sins that probably don't even exist, you create a complexity by which you do not see the big sins. In other words, as our Lord said, you strain at gnats but swallow camels. And in fact, it often goes with pride, a sense of, I am the greatest sinner, and look how much I confess. But again, it works to the destruction of communion, which was a point I brought out last week, that at root, all sin, all evil, is the fracturing of communion, the fracturing of the voice of the other within oneself and the authority of the other in communion. Professors and guides and social workers all know the frustration of counselling the scrupulous, for they then go off and just do the same thing again and again. Why is this? And I think with the scrupulous, there's something very similar to our whole modern consumer identity. Their problem is that they listen to their heart and not their head. Now, what I mean by that is a deliberate reversal of the common cliche. By heart is meant the emotions, the feelings. And when you follow the feelings, you become addicted to them. You become addicted to the drama that they provide. And thus, that kind of drama can also involve things like scrupulosity, a kind of drama of despair. In this, and in secular studies of self-deception, some of the best studies I've found have been on addicts. Yes, it's writ large with addicts, but especially gambling addicts. What one finds is the same kind of discourse again and again that justifies their gambling, and in fact, their penitence. Their very penitence becomes part of the drama. And of course, it doesn't last long, of course, because it's part of the drama. When we listen to the heart, when we allow the heart to lead us, we are led into an addictive state. But that's the thing. We are led because we find it fascinating and enjoyable and intriguing. For a while, at least, like any addiction, it ends up just a nagging insistence. As all the mystics and all religious really noted, to search oneself out, one needs the guidance of an objective, authoritative institution. And yet this is the very thing, especially in our modern hyper-consumerist world, through Hollywood, the media, and a multitude of blogs, from left liberal to neocon, this is exactly the thing that we are told to go against at every turn. We are told to basically disobey any hierarchical institutional authority. And that's why the market tells you, and that's why we introject these values of the consumer world, be spiritual, not religious. That you can be spiritual and not religious. That you can be spiritual and not fulfill your Sunday obligations. Is that right? Who told you that? Follow your own desires. Listen to your heart, not the head. What is it that the consumer world does to you? In a word, flatters. It flatters you. You are capable of deciding everything for yourself. Your opinion, well, just because it's an opinion, that's philosophy. Well, who is anyone to tell you what to think? You're quite capable. It flatters you at every turn. You and you alone are the most competent judge of what will fulfill you and make you happy. It's funny that that gets pumped out all the time, and now how many decades of pop psychology and self-help books to make you happy are still pumped out. And the same people buy them and read them, and yet the same message about you and you alone are competent to decide is still believed. Why is it that we believe this stuff? People end up buying the new product one after another, shopping for spiritual religious thrills, swallowing every great promise of easy mystical experience. And it's good for the market, but it's certainly not good for your soul. It's a sense of immediacy that is sold, because immediacy appeals to your feelings, to your passions. The sense of marketing is the sense of immediacy. Now, the point is, if you reason, if you deliberate, if you critically reflect upon yourself, then you probably won't make such a good consumer. You won't be so easily flattered. You won't buy one product after another. And now let's come at this from another angle. The demonic, the devilish. The internet and Hollywood love the style of The Exorcist, the kind of spinning heads and green vomit and all manner of things, four-letter words and computer special effects. Hollywood loves the demonic. Only it's very interesting when you read, especially the Desert Saints, and here I think some of the best collection is in the Philokalia. The Philokalia is a collection of the Desert Saints from the Eastern, from the Orthodox tradition, but there are quite a few other figures in it in the Western Church, and the same thing can be said for those Western Desert Saints as well. Now, their stories are full of struggles against demons. But their accent is not on possession. Their accent isn't on possession. In fact, they write a good deal about persuasion. Persuasion. Because their point is, it's very easy to blame the devil or the demonic for what is your responsibility. And their point was this: the demons appeal to you where you can be persuaded, and you freely assent. If we are possessed, we obviously have no real responsibility for our actions. Just as if we claim to have a medical condition for being nasty. Thomas Szasz was one of the 60s anti-psychiatrists. He was an atheist, by the way. Thomas Szasz, with people like Ronald Lang, I think had quite a lot of interest to say. Now, Thomas Szasz wrote against the whole field of psychiatry for a number of reasons, but one of the things he pointed out was this, and I should say his critique of so-called ailments like schizophrenia are very, very much widely held today, but that to one side. He noted in the hundreds and hundreds of cases he had dealt with, in the hundreds of thousands of cases that he had read, in all the cases of people who claimed to be mad or put out they were mad, in all the cases of people hearing voices by which they would be led to do something horrible to people, Thomas Szasz noted this. He never read a case in which someone who claimed they were schizophrenic said, "Oh, the voices told me to be kind. The voices told me to be really nice and gentle and considerate of people." Why was that, he said. And his answer was, because he felt that it was a construct which enabled people to evade the moral responsibility and to be nasty. Now, how far you want to take that is another matter. But I think it's a very salient point that also sheds light on Hollywood's love of the dramatic in the demonic. The accent on possession and not on persuasion and moral responsibility in accepting that persuasion. As I said, the fundamental ruse of lying, of self-deception, is to evade responsibility, to conceal our intentions, and to convince ourselves we are not culpable. I'm not blind, and I'm not blind to being blind. There's an excellent essay by Plutarch, the first century AD Greek writer, and it's in the collection of what is called the Moralia, collections of essays of his. And if you've never read Plutarch, you should, because he's a very good writer. But there's one really, really excellent essay that I often use, and it's called How to Spot a Flatterer. How to spot a flatterer. We might say a con artist. The flatterer, or as I stress, we might say the con artist, lies to us where we lie to ourselves. They have a radar. They can pick up where it is you are liable to, as it were. And this is what Plutarch wrote. In our love of ourselves, he has an excellent base of operations against us. It is because of this self-love that everybody is himself his own foremost and greatest flatterer, and hence finds no difficulty in admitting the outsider to witness with him to confirm his own conceits and desires. In our love of self, in our love of ourselves, a flatterer has an excellent base of operations. It's because of this self-love that everybody is their own foremost and greatest flatterer. All the flatterer, the con artist, has to do is find out where you're conning yourself and move in and echo that. There's a lot more to the essay than that, and I really would recommend you go and find it, but Plutarch notes how loftiness or conceit makes us to be at the mercy, quote, of the insignificant and mean. Conceit, pride, self-deception makes us at the mercy of the insignificant and mean. And that's in respect of ourselves as well. This does, but of course, what is mean and nasty does not present itself as that. It presents itself as the charming, as more often as the nice. There's some, as it were, pop psychology books that sometimes have some very good parts in. And one of them is a book by a fellow called Gavin DeBecker. It's called The Gift of Fear, and it came out in 1997. Gavin DeBecker worked his trade as being a consultant for movie stars and others who have stalkers, and also for women who fear being attacked. And he notes the ruses by which con artists or attackers use to get under your defenses. And niceness is chief among them. Quote, "Niceness is a decision, a strategy of social interaction. It is not a character trait. People seeking to control others almost always present the image of a nice person in the beginning," which is rather common sense. But if that's how the external con artist works, what about the internal con artist in you? How do you flatter yourself? How are you nice to yourself, but in order to be destructive? How many times do we think that we have become spiritual, that we have started on the inner journey proper, that we have had certain ecstasies or feelings of oceanic bliss, of oneness with things? And those things are good in themselves, I guess, but I think they're natural things that come through the training of attention and focus, and they're good things in and of themselves. But they're not necessarily supernatural things. But how often do we, when we start on the inner journey, do we think, well, yes, I'm looking at myself and I don't see that I'm lying to myself, therefore I must be really enlightened? How many times do we do that? And how many times, therefore, do we conclude that we do not need the authority of another or an institution to guide us? Because after all, we can buy the requisite books from the local bookshop, or download it, or put it on our Kindle. In other words, we become a law unto ourselves, which is what autonomous means, as I said last week. It literally means the law of the same. And this brings us back to conscience. As I say, I don't think I need to go over how not only the church, but throughout the global and the global capitalist world, conscience has come to mean a sense of ultimate autonomy. An ultimate autonomy of judgment by the individual self, such that by appealing to it, a person can pick and choose what it is that they will assent to in the church or the magisterium, or indeed in any religion or any politics for that matter. One of the very interesting phenomena in the contemporary church is this. Both those in the liberal area use conscience to undermine the authority of the church, but so too Lefebvreites, the Pius X lot, so-called ultra-conservatives use conscience as well, and consequently they can use it to reject the Second Vatican Council, for example. It's very interesting that those two groups should meet on the subject of the abuse of conscience. In other words, if you pick and choose according to what you feel, it's eclecticism. And eclecticism is our consumer market. The very idea that you can pick and choose as you see fit from any religious tradition is a little bit odd if you come to think of it, isn't it? On what authority do you do that? And what authority do you think that you can even... I remember, just as a kind of anecdote, being at a dinner party, and I've got to say, I'm not a scholar of Islam. I know very little about it. But at least to my credit in one way, I know I know little about it. But I was at a dinner party and someone was going on and on about how the Taliban or jihadists or Al-Qaeda or others didn't really truly represent true Islam. Perhaps that's true, I don't know. But those people saying it knew nothing about Islam, knew far less than me. And I asked, on what authority do you say that? If they were a member of the Taliban here who spent their lives studying the Quran and such, well, what are you just going to say? Oh, it's because I feel it so. Now, the point is, I'm sure I've done the same thing myself and will do the same thing myself. I'm sure I will fall into that conceit. But we all do it in our society again and again and again. And what is it that allows us to do that? What is it that makes us think we can do that? I'm quoting from an argument that was in Quadrant, and I always regret this. It was from the 90s, and I didn't take the person's name. No, it wasn't that either. But thank you. The point that the author made was this about Socrates. Socrates' dictum was that his wisdom consisted in knowing that he did not know, which is an admirable stance. But the author in this Quadrant article pointed out that that, in our modern age, had been corrupted as, I know no one knows, which is a very different thing. Because if you say you know no one knows, then you're saying you're in a supreme position by which you have assessed and judged everything. How many times do we read that? When people say, well, no one knows. I'd like to know how many people have these people spoken to? Have they read everything? What allows us, what gives us the authority to say something like that? I noted last week that there's been a shift in modernity that actually defines modernity, according to many scholars, by which you can sum up, as some authors have, from soul to self. I noted last week there's many different ideas as to what constitutes a soul, but common to them all is that the soul is defined by an orientation to that which is other, to something other, be it Platonic forms or an immanent teleology or what have you. It's always to something other. But self is actually an Anglo-Saxon word that means same, and as one person pointed out, we still use that term sometimes, self-same. There is a shift from other to same. And as I said last week, this has to do with the notion of human anthropology that is given in Genesis, in the Bible. Are we irreducibly communion beings, or are we ideally autonomous individuals? The very term conscience denotes that we are communion beings, because the prefix con means along with, alongside. The same in Greek, sunadesis. Again, the prefix sun means along with. It has a sense of being in a communion with, insofar as your knowledge is not of yourself or from yourself or to yourself alone. Conscience, the very terms conscience, both in the Latin and the Greek, the sunadesis, denote and point to the sense of soul, the sense of the authority of the other. But in the last few decades, especially under the influence of the free market, especially, that relational orientation has been turned to the orientation to the same, and that through flattery. Or in other words, advertising. Advertising, that's what it does to you. It flatters you. It wants to get your money. Fair enough, they've got to make a buck. They've got to sell their product. But that's what it's doing. And it does this by encouraging you to give authority to your feelings. But feelings, as we all know, are flighty things. They quickly pass. They give us to highs and lows. We, I guess, live in a bipolar society. No feelings last, of course. I'm sure, you know, as I've said, we're all over 2 or 3 years old. I'm sure we all realize that. And yet we don't seem to realize it. All our feelings will pass. There are deeper ones that we hope will remain and will remain, but they will pass. But the problem is, when you give authority to feelings, as I said before, you'll have what occurs as an addiction. Of course, the first parts of addiction, whatever it is always glorious and amazing and nice and pleasurable. Of course it is. But very quickly, the only reason you're taking a drug or jumping off a building or driving fast or having another affair or what have you is because you've got a nagging insistence in you now, and you've got to do whatever it is you've got to do in order to shut that nagging up. That's how self-deception works. It's as it says in Proverbs, when it puts forward the antithesis of lady wisdom, it presents the image of an adulterous whore on the side of the road, luring people into her bed, which is very sweet at first, but as it says in Proverbs, leads to hell. Again, surely all of us know this. Surely all of us know that the adulterous liaison, the mistress or the guy or whiz, surely we all know he or she is just going to end up a slob and a nag like your current partner. Hopefully not, but people are people in that way. But why is it we delude ourselves like this? Why? One finds all of this, I think, especially in the spiritual realm, so-called today, where the spiritual is divided off from the religious, where the desire is for mystical exaltation. That desire for mystical exaltation. Look, overwhelming feelings of mystical exaltation are not difficult to come by, actually. They're not difficult. If you just do it a little bit longer, you'll get there. But it's for this reason that basically most, if not all, religious traditions have always said they're a problem. They're a problem because they suck you in, they delude you. They're a problem on the path of true spiritual journey because suddenly you have these beautiful mystical exaltations, you think that you're there, and you just become an incredible, pious, conceited bore to everyone. It's no surprise that in New Age, and indeed, unfortunately, in much Christian spirituality, we find people like Eckhart Tolle, or Tolle, or books like The Secret, or indeed the 1990s books by Walsh, Conversations with God, or Shirley MacLaine, or a million billion other ones. What is it that they tell you? That you're God. You're the universe. And all you need to do, if you really want money and success and everything, all you need to do is really want it, desire it, feel it. Personally, I feel I couldn't think of anything more satanic, but there you are. People even within the church think highly of some of these works. Why is it believed? Why is it so readily believed? Flattery. Flattery. You see, if you can be cut off from an objective institutional guidance, you're fair game. You're fair game. It's like scrupulosity. In scrupulosity, you're listening to your heart and not your confessor. You're listening to your heart and not the church. You've given authority to your heart. The fact that you might blame the church when the church is usually far more charitable than you is only an indication of how deceived you are. The ultimate thrill is the sense of being everything. I am all. I am everything. I am God. I am the pure, unlimited experience of pure consciousness, because that is the accent on same. On the same. I am it. I am everything. And all of this, as I say, goes hand in hand, encouraging you to decry any institutional objective authority. For the aim is to split off not only you as the individual from yourself, but also from you, from all society. And thus, once you are split off, once you are divorced from an authoritative communion, you are malleable. You're plastic. You see, with hierarchical institution, with dogma, like reason, you know where you stand. You know where you stand. There is an objective standard to appeal to be checked by. But, of course, institutions too can become corrupt. And they do so when those within those institutions start to cut themselves off from the magisterium, whatever it may be in that institution, and to start using discretionary power of their own. They become nice. They start to locate the authority in themselves, and they start schism. When the orientation is taken from the objective authority and located in the same to feelings, then arbitrariness takes place. And in arbitrariness, everything is malleable. And again, it's interesting to see in our contemporary world, and I'll return to this next week, the idea of the self, the so-called crisis of the subject that it's referred to, or the idea of the postmodern self, is the idea that it is polymorphous. And what that means is this. The idea is that there's no substance to the self, that the self can become anything it wants, that it is totally malleable. That's not a rare opinion. But this is the height of modernity, and this is where the autonomous individual ends up, in a kind of arbitrary malleability. So how many times do you feel plastic and malleable and non-focused and insubstantial? Well, if you do, you've interjected those values and you deceive yourself with those values. So what to do? One needs to trace oneself out. you need to ask yourself the first and foremost question: what is your authority? What is really your authority? I mean, I'm sure it'll say, oh, God, Jesus, something like that. But you really have to trace it out. Painstakingly trace it out. You must look at objective factors. For example, things that may not seem even important, but I mean things like, what shows do you watch on television? What films do you really, really enjoy? Look, that may certainly be indifferent, but you need to trace yourself out. You need to get an objective look at yourself. What books do you read? Perhaps you don't read books. What magazines? All of those things you should try and trace out objectively, not necessarily that they're wrong, but just in order to be able to get something of an objective image of yourself. What do you pick and choose to believe? Try to think on what basis you do this. You need to clarify, you need to bring into the open what your authority is if you are going to have any hope in seeing whether or not you are blind to being blind. In the Bible, conscience means sincerity. First and foremost, it means an accord between the inner and the outer, the heart and the mouth, the heart and the tongue, such that one is not double, one is not a hypocrite. As I said last week with Hebrews 4:12, the word of God searches us out. If we make conscience little more than the voice of our feelings, then we have already corrupted the very means by which we can challenge ourselves. Conscience is the voice of the other. It's the voice of justice within us. It's a voice by which we can transcend our narrow sameness. And consequently, it's conscience that will be the first object of our attempts to deceive ourselves. What is our authority? Towards what are we oriented? Conscience, as I said, is the opening within us that allows us, in a way, to escape ourselves, to escape the stifling imprisonment of the law of sameness. Conscience is meant to challenge our conceit, and chiefly the conceit that we know it all. In self-deception, as I said, we first of all look to corrupt conscience, and we are badly placed. We are badly placed. For we live in a society, the very economics of which, the very culture of which, encourages us to make of conscience individual autonomy. We are badly placed. We are, of course, well placed in terms of livelihood and shelter and food and so forth and all the pleasures of the flesh. But I do think that we are very badly and very perilously placed in terms of the culture that we live within. For our culture is far more than any other culture that I can think of, a culture of flattery. Because that's how a consumer market, how advertising, how modernity works. Consequently, I think God looks upon us graciously in this matter because we are so badly placed. Finally, the Bible paints an unsparing portrait of the human condition this side of the fall and this side of the beatific vision. And yet it also presents an inspiring picture. A picture of what we were created to be and are, in fact, called to be. Genesis begins with unfallen humanity in the garden, and they are very, very close friends of God. But in fact, the Bible ends and time will end, will come to its perfection and fulfillment and its real beginning with humanity being the lover of God, who in the church is to be married to her Lord. The beginning of creation begins with us being friends of God, and yet the perfection of creation ends with us being the lovers of God. Walter Hilton, as with other Christian writers, liked paradox. They are resolutely opposed to self-esteem. And the reason why they're opposed to the cult of self-esteem is because its estimation of human nature is far too small. The cult of self-esteem fails largely because it does not esteem human nature greatly enough. When we have caught a glimpse of what God's grace calls us to be, then we know that the arduousness, the discipline and the obedience, the confessions, the pains, the penitence, the deprivations, the struggle and the demanding journey are worth it. That's a point that St. John of the Cross made and what Blessed Mother Teresa understood, that the work of the grace of God, the true mystical journey, is often far more in those periods when we feel nothing except emptiness. And yet, we exercise a responsibility and plow on nevertheless. We soon learn that our wounds are the entrance to our soul. And through this, we begin to understand, as St. Paul said, that with the saints, we will soon begin to understand how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know the love that surpasses knowledge, so that we may be filled with all the fullness of God. It's in Ephesians chapter 3, 18 to 19. Now that is estimating human nature highly.
That was a talk by Dr. Robert Tilley entitled Being Blind to Being Blind: The Corruption of Conscience and the Evasion of Self-Responsibility. This was the second talk from Dr. Tilley's series, The Bible and the Mystery of Self-Deception, which was presented at the Catholic Institute of Sydney. For more talks, visit cradio.org.au.